you can follow us on a regular basis as well. Well, today I want to start with a number of short economic updates. So many things to comment on, so little time. The first one is the Olympics, and there are some economic and broader implications of the Olympics. The whole idea of the Olympics, all the way back to ancient Greece when they began, was to have groups, communities, cities, countries overcome their differences, their distances, their hostilities, their arguments, to do something that the whole human race could together enjoy. And that was what the human being, in this case the human being focused on athletics, could achieve. What spectacular jumping and running and hurling a discus or whatever it was, to see what engaged human beings, our fellow citizens, could do, regardless of the community they came from, the religion they had, the origin of their birth, and so on. What do we have today? Well, what tends to happen, and I've been watching the Olympics like most of you have, has been that the athleticism gets pushed back. And what is foregrounded is who wins and who loses, not the beauty of what is being achieved here. Which country gets an advantage? How many medals do you have? What country is plowing money in there to get the benefits, the profits that come from the news teams that come to your country and eat in your restaurants and live in your hotels? It's sort of the pollution of the whole beauty of the idea back into a competitive struggle, company versus company, country versus country. It's kind of sad. Second thing I want to comment on is an act of courage, a remarkable act of courage that caught my attention. It has to do with the faculty, the people who teach at the University of Illinois in Chicago. They went on strike. In fact, a total of 1,100 professors, instructors, non-tenured and tenured faculty alike, striking, not just for better wages and working conditions, which they deserve and haven't had for a while, but also because they make the point, which I know as a professor as well, you cannot teach properly. You cannot give the attention and the time it takes to be on top of your field and give that benefit to your students if you don't have the time, and that means you can't teach 27 courses in 6 different universities, and you can't do more work than is possible if you're going to keep up with your profession. To have a school that really teaches people, you have to pay the professors to do it. And that hasn't been done. And the faculty at the University of Illinois in Chicago make a very, very good point. They say their university is run like a business. And a business, they point out, is there to make profit. But that's not what a university was. That's not what a university ought to be. And that's not what a university is. If you make profit, you sacrifice. That's the lesson of all universities. You sacrifice the quality of the education you provide. You're looking for the money. Education is a mysterious process in which people who understand things convey that and the excitement about learning and mastering a subject to their students. That oughtn't to be governed by profit. It ought to be governed by what it's about, education. And the faculties at so many universities have quietly and gutlessly accepted the transformation of their institutions into businesses. So our hats off to the courageous faculty of the University of Illinois in Chicago for having the courage to fight back for a better education and a better deal for themselves as the ones with the most responsibility to provide that education. I also want to take my hat off in another way to the Chevron Corporation. They did us a service in a peculiar way this last week when they had an explosion at a Chevron natural gas well in Bobtown, Pennsylvania. They didn't take care to prevent that real well. They failed if they made efforts at all. And the natural gas well exploded. It killed a worker from Bobtown, Pennsylvania. The fire burned for 4 days, and gas and heat are still coming from that site. The cause of the explosion remains unknown, at least as of the day before yesterday. And even the Chevron Corporation said the situation, quote, remains serious. But then the Chevron Corporation did something stunning. Here is a big oil company wrapped up in that whole fracking disaster that threatens so many communities across the United States. And here they are showing that they're not a very effective custodian of what they do. They may be making a lot of profits. Their stock may be in good shape, but they're exploding wells and killing people in Pennsylvania. So what did Chevron do? I'm not making this up, you know, because I couldn't imagine it. So I'm just going to tell it to you straight. Okay? Chevron decided to give every resident of Bobtown, in response to this explosion that killed a person, a certificate good for one free pizza and a 2-liter bottle of soda. An apology to the people of Bobtown, Pennsylvania, of pizza and soda. I told you I couldn't make this up. This is the idea of the Chevron Corporation as to what its responsibilities are. Oh, you run a gas line through a community. You put its entire population at risk, breathing horrible stuff, polluting their water, exploding the wells, killing people. And what you think you owe the community isn't to find new and better sources of energy, ones that don't threaten folks, isn't ways to move gas and oil around the world in ways that don't threaten folks, if indeed there are such ways. No. This is the attitude of a corporation that when it kills people in the pursuit of profit, sends their neighbors a pizza and some soda. Shame on Chevron? That's much too mild. This is a sign of where corporate America is going in its haughty attitude of business first, the bottom line, profits ahead of everything else. The Gallup poll, released last week, also offers an interesting piece of economic update. This poll was conducted between February 6th and February 9th. And the Gallup poll resulted in the following. 23%, roughly a quarter, of Americans polled by Gallup consider unemployment the greatest challenge facing the nation. That's up from only 16% as recently as January. How does Gallup explain this? Very interesting. For months before this new feeling of Americans that unemployment is the biggest problem of the country, they thought it was government and politicians. That was the view of Americans after the shutdown last year provoked by the fighting between Republicans and Democrats. Then they thought, my God, it's our politicians and government that refuses to function. That's our biggest problem. But as that shutdown receded in memory, the underlying economic reality imposed itself on Americans, and they began to understand, yes, yes, our problem is unemployment. How interesting that in the same week that this poll was conducted, the United States Senate once again failed to extend unemployment benefits to the long-term unemployed, which had lapsed for 1.7 million Americans at the end of last December. What am I bringing to a head? The gap. The American people are clear. Unemployment is our number one problem. But the government and the politicians, who've never considered a public employment program to address that problem, who have for 6 years said, we're going to rely on the private sector. And the private sector is still a long way from recovering to the level of unemployment we had before this crisis began in 2007. The people know that unemployment is the problem, but their politicians refuse to deal with it. Last two of my quickie updates for today. Bloomberg, the financial service, provided information that the debts of Americans, the amount of debt Americans took on, mortgage debt, student debt, credit card debt, car payment debt, rose in the last quarter of 2013 by the highest rate since this great crisis began in 2007. 2.1% increase in the last quarter of 2013 alone. Wow. What does that tell us? It tells us that the American economy, this capitalist economy which ran into a stone wall in 2007, which plunged this economy into the worst economic crisis since the 1930s, and a crisis which we all know was heavily shaped by the fact that wages weren't raised by workers, leading them to take on more and more debt, that home lenders, banks pushed on them, that were pushed on them by the banks through the credit cards, that were pushed on students by the rising cost of education just at a time when American families haven't got the money to pay for it. This growth in debt led to the crisis. What have we learned from that? Nothing, it turns out. Americans are again facing stagnant wages. Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that for the last month, January, real wages in America were flat again, going nowhere. The costs of everything rising, but the real capacity to buy things going nowhere. So what did Americans do? Yup, they borrowed more. And what were banks more than willing to do? Lend it to them. We're on the same train that hit a stone wall, and we're going to end up in the same place. This is a serious problem. And what the report from Bloomberg shows is the same mechanisms haven't been changed. The same greedy banks pushing the credit, the same needy Americans borrowing, the recipe for disaster in full bloom. Last update. Or next to last, if I can squeeze in two. 1.7 million Europeans did something remarkable over the last few months. It turns out that in Europe, where they have a European-wide parliament, in addition to the parliaments in each country, France has its own Congress or parliament, the Germans do, the Italians do, but there's also a European parliament. And Europeans vote in two elections, their national elections and the European elections. But their system has an interesting thing we don't have in the United States. In the United States, the only way to get a bill to be considered in the Senate and the House of Representatives, to be passed, hopefully, and signed by the president into law, the only people who can introduce a bill are the elected representatives, not in Europe. In Europe, if 1 million citizens, that's a huge number, if 1 million citizens sign a petition in at least seven or more European countries out of the 28 that are part of this European Parliament, then the people can put a bill before the legislators. Not a legislator, the people, by their act of signing more than 1 million signatures, can make their parliament deal with what they want. How interesting. Maybe then we could have a poll in this country about unemployment being the biggest problem and make our legislators deal with it in a way that they haven't. But here's the most interesting thing. Not only did 1 million Europeans sign such a petition, 1.7 million did. 700,000 more than they needed. And here's what the bill is that the people of Europe voted. They don't want their water privatized. They don't want to see private water companies. Water, this petition said, is a human right. It's something every human being needs many times a day. It is something that ought to be provided to people because they're human and they're alive. And it shouldn't be something where there's a bottom line for some capitalist enterprise to make money and either misuse the water or hold back the water or adulterate the water or pollute the water. Water is not to be a commodity to be made money on. What an interesting use of the power of the people in that society called Europe. And I wanted to make sure you all saw this act against the logic of capitalism to make something basic available to everybody, regardless of their ability to pay, and not subject to anyone making money off the process. I will take another moment, a moment that I don't really have, to give you one more. This is a statistic that I want you to think about. It has to do with the economy on the one hand and marriage on the other. And here I'm taking something, a very interesting article by Sam Pizzigatti, whose work I acknowledge because I often make use of it. He had a piece in Salon.com, the journal on the internet, February 16th, for those of you that are interested. And here he points out the following. In 1960, 72% of Americans were in a marriage. 72% of Americans over 18 were in a marriage. 2010, the same statistic, how many Americans over 18 were in a marriage, dropped from 72% to 51%. Half of Americans over 18 were in a marriage, half were not. And when research was done, and Pizzigatti points to it, here are the interesting results. It's the pressure of a bad labor market. The fact that jobs are harder to come by. The fact that more and more people have to piece together more than one job. The fact that the jobs don't pay very much. The fact that many, many companies, in very many clever ways, push the job they used to do onto you, the consumer. You have to go through 12 phone calls. You have to do stuff on the internet. They shift the burden of what they ostensibly are producing for you onto you. You become an unpaid cooperator in what they do, and it destroys marriages. All that talk about family values, and the reality is the people who do that talk are the biggest boosters of private enterprise, a private enterprise that has done more to end and compromise marriage than any other force in our society. Okay, let's turn then, in the time that we have now, as we often do, to a major issue. And I want, in the major issue for today, to take a little time on what I call part two of what we began last week. We began last week with a discussion of what was the Soviet Union. Many of you have asked me to talk a little bit about the economic system that was the Soviet Union, that kind of socialism, in order for us to think about what is a possible alternative to a capitalism that is working as poorly as the one we're living with now. If you recall last week in part one of this two-part discussion, I pointed out that there are two fundamental misunderstandings of what Soviet socialism was. First of all, it was not the end of markets. The Soviet Union never got rid of markets. And through most of the history of the Soviet Union, what the government did was endorse, support, make possible, but also regulate markets. So you didn't have no markets. What you had was a market with massive amounts of government intervention. Now, I also pointed out that even in what we consider capitalist economies, all governments always intervene in markets. They do it in different ways, and they do it to different degrees. But the notion of a market in which governments do not intervene is a fantasy of economists and otherwise poorly informed folks. The United States intervenes in the market in this country in countless ways, by controlling prices, by controlling wages, by setting limits, by inspecting and controlling in a thousand ways. The prices that result in our markets are not free market prices, because the notion of a free market, free of government intervention, is a fantasy. There are differences of degree and kind in how governments intervene. And the Soviet Union clearly was on the end of lots of intervention in lots of ways. But it's a matter of degree, not the presence or absence of a market. And I likewise pointed out last week that private property was never eliminated in the Soviet Union. That private property was in fact expanded in the first part of its history when all peasants were given land, and they had never had it before, and that land was their private property, which they could and did buy and sell. And that even after the collectivization of agriculture, all peasants were given what were called private plots. And those private plots were, for all practical purposes, their private property to use as they wish. But that's enough for what the Soviet Union wasn't. What was it? And what is it about the Soviet Union that qualifies them, and perhaps you, that's your choice, to call them socialist? Here's the way it worked. The government in industry, not in agriculture until later in its history, but for all of its history in the Soviet Union, the government took over most industrial activity. Manufacturing and services were run by the government. Instead of a private enterprise, the government took over the enterprise in industry and ran it. What did this mean? It meant that the workers came 9 to 5 or whatever the hours were, just as they had before. They worked all day. They used their brains and their muscles to produce industrial goods, physical goods and services. And when they were done, the workers went home. And when the workers went home, they left behind, in the hands of the enterprise, the goods and the services they had helped to produce. Whose property did they become? The property of the enterprise. And since the enterprise was owned by the government, the output was the property of the government. The government then arranged to sell it, just like a private enterprise might. They sold the enterprise's outputs either back to the working people for consumer goods, shirts, hamburgers, software programs, whatever. Or the government sold the output of one enterprise that it owned to another enterprise that it owned. It handled that as an internal market transfer between enterprises, even allowed these enterprises to bargain and dicker with one another over the price they paid each other for their output. So what we have is an enterprise which no longer had a private board of directors selected by the private owners of the shares of the company. That was all gone. Stock market was closed in the Soviet Union. There was no buying and selling of shares. The government owned everything in the realm of industry, and therefore the government kept for itself the profits. If what they sold from the output was worth more in the prices that the government set than what they paid to the workers and for their inputs, if there was a net revenue or profit or surplus, whatever you want to call it, then the government received it. So now what did the government do with the industrial profits that it gathered into its hands from all of the industries it operated? Here's what it did. Number one, it used it to build up their industry. The Soviets were very interested in becoming a modern industrialized economy, so they took a large part of the profits and used them to expand the infrastructure of the Soviet Union, to build more and more factories, to go from a poor backward country, which is what they were in 1917, to become the superpower right after the United States by the 1960s. An amazing achievement. All the more amazing if you remember that between the time of their revolution and the time they become the world's second superpower, there were 2 world wars, a revolution in their country, and a civil war. To go through all that and to still become the world's number 2 superpower gives you an idea of one of the advantages that the Soviet Union had by socializing its industry, by making it all one big family of government enterprises. The government could and did gather into its hands all the profits that those industries were capable, all the excess of output those workers produced over and above what they themselves got for their own spending in their own wages. That surplus, that profit, the government used to build itself up. And the rate of economic growth achieved by the Soviet Union, like that achieved by the People's Republic of China in the last 20 years, are among the most spectacular economic growth stories in the history of the world. Both of those societies, Russia, the Soviet Union in its first 40 years, and the People's Republic of China in its first 40 years achieved much faster rates of economic growth than any capitalist country has ever achieved. That's an advantage. What else did they use their profits for in Russia? They built up their military. They felt encircled, they felt threatened, so they built up the second most powerful military force in the world. That was also something that they were able to do by virtue of the way they organized their economy. And finally, they used a portion of these profits to create collective consumption, to provide a rising standard of living for their working people. Improving the housing, improving the education, improving the health care, and so on. So this was a Soviet kind of socialism in which the government plays an absolutely enormous role, becoming, if you like, the capitalist for all of the industries, collecting all those profits and using them to grow quickly, to build a powerful military, and to enhance the collective consumption. Not the individual consumption. Wages did not go up very much, but what the government provided to supplement was the very use of those surpluses to help the mass of people. So they were very successful. But here's what they were not. They didn't turn over the factories to the working people. It wasn't socialism in the sense that Marx and others had long written about, where instead of a capitalist, a group of individuals who'd make all the decisions, you're a worker, you help produce a surplus, they get it, and they decide what to do with it, you're excluded from all of that. That's what capitalism is. That's what we have in the United States or Western Europe or Japan or much of the world. Mass of people do the work, tiny minority gather the surplus into their hands, the profits, and decide what to do with it. The Soviet Union changed that, got rid of the private owners and the private capitalists, but it substituted the government. It substituted the bureaucracy set up to manage this. That gave them a different history. That gave them a different quality of life. What it didn't give them was the idea that the workers themselves would take over, that they would run their own enterprises, make their own decisions collectively about what to do with the surplus, the profits that they collectively helped to produce. That idea of a worker cooperative, of a worker self-directed enterprise, that concept of socialism was not instituted in the Soviet Union, nor in China. So whether you want to call the government takeover and all that happened under that socialism, that's your business. Whether you want to reserve that term for something that hasn't happened yet on a massive scale, namely workers taking over the enterprise, and only call that socialism, that's a debate among socialists, and that's your decision to make in terms of your own position. But if you want to understand what the Soviet Union was, it was the collectivization under the head of the government of all the surpluses. It wasn't the transformation of the actual workplace, which is what Marx talked about when he focused his critique of capitalism. Please stay with me. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. This is Richard Wolff. I'm your host on Economic Update. I want to remind you that if this program and others like it are of interest, please take advantage of the free websites that we maintain for your use. The first is rdwolff2fs.com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Both of these are available free of charge 24/7. Both of them have video presentations of lectures and talks I've given around the United States and abroad. They have interviews on mass media, radio, television, and so on. All of our programs, this one included, is archived on these websites. Much is available to you, including the opportunity of communicating to us. So we ask you and invite you to take advantage of them. You can also reach and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest through those websites. I want to talk today, in the second of our longer discussions, about retirement in the United States. I want to compare what has been going on, because it is a kind of hidden part of our economy that should come out into the light. I say hidden because the arrangements made now about retirement don't show up in people's lives until they retire. All kinds of adjustments have been going on in recent years and are going on right now that you need to be aware of, either because you're going to retire 5, 10, 20 years from now and then become dependent on the arrangements we're going to be talking about, or even if that isn't, if you're young and you're not there yet, please remember that if you have elderly relatives, if you're one of those people that has a mother and a father, like most of us do, those folks, as they get older, will either have the financial support to live on their own the way they want, to have enough to take care of a decent retirement, or they will turn to you for help. What else can they do if there's no other way for them to get by? So you, however young you are, you also have an interest in the retirement economics, because they're going to affect you too. They're going to affect everyone. So let's begin. I want to compare the retirement situation 25 years ago with the one we have today, so that we can all understand what the actuality is and how it's going to shape out and impact us in the immediate future. 25 years ago, something was true that is still true today. And it's a stunning statistic. One half of the American people have no pension. I'm going to say it again. One half of the American people have no pension. This is the same half that basically have little or no savings, which means this half is dependent on whatever the government Social Security program provides for them. Since the average amount of money given by Social Security is not enough to live on, puts you absolutely in the realm of the poor in this country. It's below the poverty cutoff. You can understand the implications of what I just said. One of the richest countries in the world, half of its people have no pension. Now let's turn to the other half, the half that does. 25 years ago, most of the pensions that people had came from their jobs. And the job pension was called a defined benefit plan. It was typically a plan into which you as a worker put a little bit of money, your employer matched it or sometimes generously gave more than you put in, and that money accumulated over the years you worked so that when you retired, you got a very nice payout that allowed you to live in a style that wasn't at least drastically worse than the one you had enjoyed while working. That has all changed in the last 50 years, last 25 years. Most people now do not have a private defined benefit pension from their employer of the sort I just described. Instead, what most workers got as they lost their pensions was something called a 401k plan. That's a government-defined arrangement in which you put aside money, more or less. Your employer contributes money, more or less. And I'm going to have a lot to tell you about that in a minute. And the money is invested. That is, the contribution is what's defined in the pension. But what you get when you retire depends on how those investments go. If you invest in something that rises over time, then you'll have more when you retire. If you invest in something that doesn't, you won't. If between now and the time you retire, the stock market has a dive of the sort it had in 2007, 2008, and 2009, you'll be in serious trouble. There's no fixed commitment from your employer to give you a sum that you could live on. It's all a matter of the ups and downs of the world of stocks and bonds. So everybody is, in that way, less secure. But it's actually much worse, and that's why I'm bringing it to your attention. Let me give you one idea. There's really much to say here, and we don't have enough time. But I was struck back on the 14th of February, 2014, when the Bloomberg Financial Service, and by the way, I mentioned some of these sources because I want you to be aware that I'm taking this material from the most business-friendly sources I can find most of the time. The Bloomberg Financial Service carried a story by Carol Heimowitz and Margaret Collins, again on February 14th, called, and here's the title of the story, and I'll tell you about it, Companies Squeeze 401k Plans from Facebook to JP Morgan. Here's what the story details. Most workers do not pay attention and cannot even understand the documents that come to them regularly about their 401k plan. That is, the pension that they're going to rely on later, how much money they're putting in, how much money the company's putting in, so that they have some idea of how safe and secure they will be when they retire. So what companies have been doing, knowing that, is reacting to the economic downturn in this country since 2007 by cutting back how much they put in to the 401k plans. The Bloomberg story details this. Quote, I'm reading now from the story. Major companies that have engaged in such practices in recent years include the Whole Foods Market, Facebook, Oracle Corporation, Caesars Entertainment Corporation, and JP Morgan Chase. Wow, that's just a partial list, and those are monster companies affecting hundreds of thousands of working people. They're cutting back. A small cutback now, when you compound it at interest over many years, is going to make a big impact in reducing the value of your pension. Wow. Here's a comment from Bridget Madrian, a Harvard Kennedy School professor who studies retirement policies, talking about these 401ks. Quote, most individuals can't do it on their own, and we're going in the wrong directions. Here's the so-called bottom line. First, half the people don't have a pension. Second, the half who had a pension don't anymore get a clear benefit. They only get an amount contributed. And in fact, their employers are cutting back on the contributions. And the workers can take the money out before they retire to face their own ups and downs. Bottom line, the retirement story is getting grim. More and more, it's turning out that, to give you one example, research at Boston College shows that in retirement accounts and 401ks combined, individual retirement accounts where people save, plus their 401ks, people aged 55 to 64 had just 120,000 in 2010. If you take out from that what you're supposed to per year, it's $4,800. You can't live on that, and you can't live on that plus Social Security unless you specialize in eating cat food and lots of spaghetti and soup, and you don't care where you live. What we are doing is saving money now. Our corporations are saving on the contributions they make, and we are saving our economic problems by dipping into our 401ks. What we're not wanting to face is that within a few years, we are going to have a very big problem. As millions of baby boomers and others retire from their jobs and begin to depend on Social Security, which is cutting back, on their personal savings, which are not large and which have been shrinking, and now on their 401k retirement plans, into which their employers have been putting less and less, and from which they've had to dip into. You put all that together, and you're talking about a society that is going to be facing the severe problem of its elderly, and that are going to impinge, therefore, on every person's life. This is not a reasonable or a rational way to organize a society. At the same time that we have record numbers of millionaires and billionaires, at a time when the rich are becoming much richer relative to everybody else, we are undercutting systematically the economic well-being and welfare of the mass of our people. And this retirement outrage is just another part, a little bit below the radar, of what is unfolding. The question really becomes, how many ways is an economic system like ours going to be allowed to fail more people in more ways until finally the mass of people stop, look around, and say, what's that going down? And say it can't continue. You cannot have a society giving so much to so few and taking so much from so many. Let me turn now to respond to a question that, in fact, several of you have been sending in various forms to us. So I thought it would be time to address this question in the hope that I can clarify some of the issues. The question is about... for your wage and your salary. All prices of goods and services going up is what we mean by inflation. Well, then deflation is the opposite. That's when prices go down. Prices drop. Wages drop. All prices of goods and service keep falling. It can happen quickly. It can happen slowly. Deflation has happened historically. Recently, it's been a problem in Japan, for example. It happened in the 1930s in the Great Depression of the United States. And indeed, deflations tend to happen when economic crises occur, when jobs are disappearing, when companies are going out of business, when production cuts back. Typically, what happens is a company discovers that it cannot sell what it has been producing, that it is beginning to build up its inventories of unsold goods that its workers produced, and it's getting panicky, the company, because it can only survive if it can sell. After all, it paid those workers to produce these things. It paid all the vendors from whom it bought inputs to make what it produces. That money has been spent. They have to recoup it. They have to make their income by selling the output of the people they employ. What happens if suddenly there's no market for that stuff? They can't sell it. One of the things companies sometimes do, not always, is to try to respond to that situation by lowering the price of what they've produced in the hope that people will jump to buy that output, thereby they will sell it, if they drop the price. If companies start doing that in large number, then of course it makes it possible for other companies who buy the goods of the first group of companies to say, well, since the goods we're buying are dropping in price, we can afford to solve our problems of unsold goods by also dropping our price. So the kind of snowball effect, it feeds on itself. And of course, employers turn immediately to their workers and say, look, we're having to cut the price of everything we sell, so we can only afford to pay you something less than we used to pay you. So the wages go down. Well, if the prices go down and then the wages go down, we have a deflation. In the last 6 or 7 years, as the crisis has hit North America, Europe, Japan, the whole world, And as the crisis proved to be deeper and longer than anyone had foreseen, it became more and more tempting for more and more companies to cut their prices. Deflation became a worry of governments and economic advisors and planners because it was becoming a more urgent prospect for more and more companies and for workers who would face downward pressure on their wages. One of the reasons the Federal Reserve in the United States, the European Central Bank, the Bank of Japan, indeed many government banks around the world, pumped historically unprecedented amounts of money into world economies was to prevent a deflation from happening, to pump in so much money that there would be enough money for producers not to have to cut their price. They would find people with money to buy what they produce without a price cut. Why were they so afraid of deflation? Well, I'll give you two examples. One, deflation tends to feed on itself. Think of it this way. If you lived in a society, an economy, in which prices were going down, that would be a built-in incentive for you to postpone purchases. Why buy that television today at $600 if prices are dropping and you have every reasonable expectation that by waiting a few more weeks, it'll be cheaper? Why buy the car for the same reason? Why buy the bed? Why buy the house? Why buy anything? So the very prospect of a deflation makes the deflation work as more and more people and businesses postpone, withhold production, putting more and more pressure on companies to sell the stuff by inducing the purchaser by another price cut and another. So in other words, you are worsening the problem. You're making it harder for companies to sell what they have because a deflation makes everyone have an incentive to wait. The second problem of a deflation that frightens everybody who thinks about it is what it does to a society that is heavily indebted. Over the last 50 years, Americans, Europeans, everyone in the world has become more and more dependent on debt. Governments are more in debt than they've ever been before. Corporations are more in debt than they have ever been before. And above all, consumers are in debt. In debt for their home, in debt for the credit cards they use, in debt for the automobiles they buy, in debt in our country here in the United States, for example, for the student loans they take out. A debt is a fixed amount of money that you owe. If the prices of everything are going down, including your income, your wage and salary going down with it, and that's part of what a deflation is, it means your ability to pay a fixed dollar loan or a fixed euro loan or a fixed yen loan is becoming harder and harder. Because as everything goes down in price, the loan denominated in money stays the same. So it becomes a bigger and bigger problem for you. That fixed loan. An indebted society explodes when there's a deflation. And we are more indebted than ever. And the terror of what that might mean as more and more people, as prices and wages go down, can't pay their debts. Well, we just came into a crisis in 2007 based on people unable to make their debts. A deflation makes that problem worse. So a deflation is a terrible fear, just like inflation is. And therein lies the lesson I want to get across. We live in an unstable capitalist system. We know that because over the last 5 or 6 years, we've had massive unemployment. We've had one kind of suffering after another. We've had what happened to retirement accounts that I spoke about a few minutes ago, and all the other things we discuss in this program every week. But at the same time, as we're struggling with a crisis of unemployment and lost production and all of the suffering that flows from it, our governments have to be terribly worried that the economy can also veer into an inflation if all that extra money that the Federal Reserve and central banks have pumped in begins to cause prices to rise. And now you also understand that the economy and the government have to worry about deflation. This is an economic system that exists on a kind of knife edge. It can fall over this way, inflation. It can fall over that way, deflation. And it can fall altogether if nobody's working and if there's no income for masses of people. What kind of an economic system is it that presents these stupefying dangers at every turn? And why, in the end, doesn't our capitalist system turn to a mechanism that would solve the problem? You know how you avoid prices going up? Well, one way is to do what President Richard Nixon did back in 1971. He declared a wage price freeze. He said on television, any American businessman or woman who raises the price will go to jail. You can't do it. That's how we stopped an inflation. Well, you could stop a deflation. You could say, well, that's just not going to happen. Private enterprises are not going to be allowed either to raise prices or to cut them. Unless and until we in the government deem it to be safe to do so in a staggered way over time, now you, not you, and so on. And in our society, private enterprises who need that to avoid the catastrophic deflation or inflation won't do it because they're afraid to give the government that power. So the real question is, why might that be? Why the fear to have the government come in, hire the unemployed, that way we solve unemployment, put on a wage price freeze so that we do not have the crazy oscillations of inflation or deflation? And the answer is political and ideological. Private enterprise are afraid. If the government is the solution, there's always this big risk for a private enterprise. Governments are elected by the majority of the people, and the majority of the people have the votes to decide what the government does. If you give the government power, in the end, you're giving that power to the mass of people. And the mass of people might, it's the great fear in capitalism, they might decide that they don't want a system called capitalism. They don't want to live worried about their retirements, worried about inflation, worried about deflation, worried about unemployment. They want a different economic system. And if you give the government the power, you give the opportunity to the mass of people to go beyond capitalism to another system, a system in the workers themselves run the enterprises and run them in their own interest, rather than having them run in the interest of the major shareholders and the boards of directors. That's the big question. That's the basic question. And it lies behind most of the other topics we discuss. Thank you very much for your attention. This is the end of another Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff.
They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change. Ain't gonna change. Yes, it is.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the March selection for the monthly Jefferson High School Multicultural Film Festival. This month, the film The Canary Effect will show on Tuesday, March 11th. The Canary Effect is a 2006 documentary that looks into the effects that the United States and its policies have on the indigenous population. That's The Canary Effect, Tuesday, March 11th at 6 p.m. at the North Killingsworth Library. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
K- KABU is sponsoring an evening on the future of schooling in Portland at the Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, March 13th. It starts at 6 p.m. with a panel discussion that addresses what's ahead for public schools after the recent fierce contract battle, the case against high-stakes testing in privatizing schools, why public schools produce higher test score performances than private schools, and how we can work together to create truly wonderful schools. Speakers include Gwen Sullivan, president of the Portland Teachers Union, also school board member Steve Buell, and folks from the High School Student Union and Oregon Save Our Schools, a parent group. After discussion, we will present the film The Inconvenient Truth About Waiting for Superman. It's a film that debunks the attack on public education and teachers' unions. It all happens on Thursday, March 13th at the Clinton Street Theater at 6 p.m.
It's 10 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's your Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Then stay tuned at 10:15 for Flashpoints. Host Dennis Bernstein speaks with law professor Francis Boyle about the possible partitioning of Ukraine and what that might mean. Also, Dennis remembers the late poet-photographer Frank Espada. At 11 o'clock on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter speaks with Karen Foster, author of No Way, Baby, Exploring, Understanding, and Defending the Decision Not to Have Children. And we want to thank you once again, KABU members, for your great support. And if you'd like to become a member, because you aren't one yet, you can go to kabu.fm and click on Donate Today. We're going to go straight to Air Cascadia.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, February 26th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. We have a very special guest live in the KBOO studios today, John Barkley. We're going to continue the discussion that we began last week on on encryption, decryption, activism. And where we stand now as an activist community confronting the most gargantuan, enormous juggernaut that the world has ever seen. But as we all know, these types of Goliaths can be taken down with a small stone. Malcolm Gladwell made that point loud and clear in his recent book. Before we get into that, just a very few headlines to get through. Joe trades out. That leaves a large slice of Northeast real estate back in play, and former proponents and opponents of the Trader Joe's store there are putting their heads together to consider what comes next for a neighborhood whose whole character has dramatically morphed into the land of the jogging stroller and the $1,000 bicycle. And a Samsung's upcoming Galaxy S5 smartphone is going to be at least the third so far to have a fingerprint sensor for security. But wait a minute. Ask any police department, and they will tell you that fingerprints are far from as they are not as unique and as unassailable an identifier of a person as we had thought. It seems that if a police department, not known for brilliant minds, has been aware of this problem for a long time, is this really a good idea? And ways in which it could easily be thwarted, jerry-rigged, manipulated seem to me the worst idea to come down the pike in a while. That's not a real security. And contaminated water, presumed to be from drilling into and fracking hydrocarbon-bearing rock strata, has been in the news for some time now. And so have global warming and air pollution issues associated with transporting and burning fossil fuels. These are deeply connected to one another, apart from the shallow horizontal the field of the 24-hour news cycle. The deep structure examined carefully, revealing the connections, is an extremely alarming picture. And as we always, the first thing you want to know is, where's the tipping point? Have we passed it? It's a little bit complicated to know. That is like predicting the weather, predicting the stock market, or for that matter, measuring a coastline. And medical marijuana dispensaries here in Oregon, in fact in Beaverton, will not be allowed within the city limits for at least 6 months, beginning on the 28th of this month. Such is the decision made by Beaverton's city councillors on Tuesday. And briefly, the National Weather Service has this for us. Slight chance of rain today, but later on, overcast skies, well, duh, how else would you get rain, with a high near 53. And the National Weather Service claims that we've got east winds 8 miles per hour. I don't think so. Certainly not out in the gorge. Tonight, rain mostly, late lows around 41, and east-northeast wind. And for tomorrow, rain lightly, highs around 50. Again, they've got the wind business all wrong, at least in my case. And for tomorrow night, again, expect a bit of rain, low clouds, and temperatures around 42. We still don't have alternative forecasts. We should have a banging good one, though, by the end of the week. And that's it, though, for the conventional weather, as well as a few headlines. It's an ominously level day as far as mainstream news, and for that matter, alternative news, although coming up on the 8th is a major action against coal. Right now, let's welcome, though, John Barkley with Free Geek. Many listeners know him well. We're delighted to have him live here in the KBOO studios. We're going to begin a discussion on encryption, decryption, and what we're talking about. What are we talking about when we talk about open source, and why is it so critical to a workable, secure system of encrypting and decrypting our personal messages?
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate the invite to talk to the KBOO community. I'm an instructor at freegeek.org in Southeast